I'm going to start today with my sermon with a poem by Elizabeth Bishop. It's called One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day, except the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places, names, cell phones that go off in the middle of a service, where it was you meant to travel. None of those things will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. Oh, the art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster some realms I own, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love. I shan't have lied. It's evident that the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. So ends the poem. I have often thought of this poem. This beautiful poem is charting something of a chronology of how human lives so often unfold. Many of us, though certainly not all of us, begin with losing those smaller things. We notice passing grade levels in schools, teachers we like that are suddenly gone from our lives. And then friends move away and pets die. And then there are first loves that end and that feel even more like disaster. And then we start losing bigger. Cities and entire chapters of our lives begin to drop away. We discover seasons that seem like they would go on forever that in fact had in them the intent to be lost. If we are lucky, we make it into adulthood without losing the most painful things, without losing the ones that truly seem like disaster when they're gone. But eventually those come too, the deaths of the ones that we love, and we have to discover the art with all of its pain and awful grace, its heartbreak and its bittersweet memories of living even into that. In August of this year, Kol Hadash, the humanistic Jewish synagogue that meets here in our building, hosted the author and Lake Forest native Rebecca Mackay. Now, Rabbi Shalom interviewed her about her book called The Great Believers. I did not know what the book was about and chose to show up to the event on a lark. Now, I had heard that the book was a National Book Award finalist and thought it would be worth hearing what the author had to say. I'm so glad that I did. It turns out that the book is set in the 1980s during the outbreak of the AIDS crisis. It is itself a meditation on life and loss, on responses to grief and of living with disaster, on what we do with the memories of those who have died. After the interview, I picked up a copy and read it in a few days. It is emotionally riveting. Now, before going into the heart of the book, I want to mention a somewhat trivial aside that may be of interest to us. It is that North Shore Unitarian Church actually gets a shout out in the novel. What was true at that time is that there were almost no churches in the Chicago area that would do memorial services for the victims of AIDS. The only place that would do it was the Unitarian Church. And while Mackay sets the church in downtown Chicago, she said during the interview that she actually based her description of the church, and especially the religious education wing, on our very own North Shore Unitarian building. What do you know? In any case, the book centers on the character of Yale Tishman, who moves to Chicago in the early 1980s. And the chronology of his losing echoes the Bishop poem. As the virus spreads, first his outer circle of acquaintances falls, and then his close friends get ill, and then his partner dies, and then he realizes that he, too, has the virus. The grief and the pain of loss is intermixed with the shame that is so often associated with the disease, and also the anger at the lack of compassion and response from the broader culture. All of it comes together in this novel. Eventually, the virus decimates nearly an entire generation of gay men, often for the smallest and most flitting mistakes. As Mackay puts it in the novel, this disease has magnified all of our mistakes. Some stupid thing you did when you were 19, the one time that you weren't careful, and it turns out that that was the most important day of your life. This line shifts the blame and guilt that is sometimes focused around HIV infection, inviting greater humility for all of us. It is dishonest to claim some moral high ground around this disease, the novel iterates to us. Rather, it is simply luck if physical destruction does not haunt our smallest acts of carelessness. Mackay layers her story within multiple generations, which makes it even richer. There is the generation that lives after the 1980s, and it is the one that has to grapple with the aftermath of that law of the losses. And there is another generation that makes frequent appearance through the recollections of an older character. This elderly woman spends time recalling her youth during World War I. She particularly remembers the artists and writers who tried to piece their lives together after the war. It was another era that lost almost an entire generation of young men. The title of Mackay's book is drawn from F. Scott Fitzgerald, who was writing in the wake of that loss. "We were the great believers," he writes. "I have never cared for any men as much as those who felt the first springs when I did and saw death ahead and were reprieved and who now walk the long, stormy summer." The 1980s generation afflicted with AIDS and the World War I generation mirror each other, generations remade through loss and grief. And that is particularly difficult to communicate to anyone who has not experienced the loss firsthand. How do you communicate the gravity of the disaster? As the author writes, they meant well, all of them, all of those people who came up to us and put their hand on our shoulder. But how could you explain to them that this city was a graveyard? That when they stepped through a pocket of cold air, didn't they understand that it was a ghost? It was a boy that the world had spat out? The question that hangs on this novel is nothing less than this. What are we to do as custodians of such memories? What do we do when others do not recognize the losses? How do we use our memory in a way that protects one another and continues to promote healing and justice? Now, I remember the first time that I saw the AIDS quilt. It had come to Cincinnati, and the Gay Straight Alliance of my high school convinced the advisors to take us on a field trip. The early January facade of the convention center was gray and brick and frost-covered and plain. And the inside was anything but that. It was an explosion of color, squares of all different hues. But the change was not joyful. It wasn't even wistful. It was instead a heavy and grief-filled vibrancy. They had speakers taking turns reading the names, the thousands of names of those who had died. And it took me about 10 minutes of listening and wondering and watching to be reduced to tears, to realize that this would be one of the most moving and beautiful and devastating elegies that I would ever witness. So many lives, so much loss. The art of losing isn't hard to master. How do you hold it all? How do you go forward when it feels so much like, write it, like disaster? The characters in the book have different ways of working through their grief and their loss. And this is what makes the novel not only humanizing, but I think in some ways hopeful. In a way, it is a prescription for our grief. The older woman who remembers the generation of World War I fights to have that artist's work, the work of a love that died prematurely during the war, publicly displayed. One of the men who survived the AIDS crisis memorializes his friends with his own photography and installations. And Fiona, a central character who survives the 80s with all of the memories and trauma of that time, with the loss of her brother heavy on her heart, struggles to open herself to life and love and her family, refusing to be shut down and completely destroyed by the losses. She struggles to share love, knowing that it is both the best way to carry forth the legacy of her past and also to honor her present and her future. I'd like to close today with some words from Forrest Church. These are words that he preached just before his own death from cancer. He wrote this: "After death, our bodies may be resurrected, or our souls may transmigrate, or we may join our loved ones in heaven, or we may return the constituent parts of our being to the earth from which it came and then rest in an eternal peace. About life after death, no one can know. But about this, we can surely know. There is love after death. Not only do our finest actions invest life with meaning and purpose, but they also live on after us. 2 centuries from now, the tracings of our being will yet express themselves in the little works of love that follow bead after bead in a luminous string extending from our dear ones out into the world and then on into the next, strung by our own loving hands." And so it is. And so it's true. Let us remember that however great the loss, however much of a disaster it is, there is also a love that cannot die, a love that we make immortal in our sharing, in our bringing it forth into this world. That is the beauty and the power of our witness, a gift that we give to those who came before, and a gift that they continue to offer to us through all of our days. Let it be so. Amen. I love you, and blessed be.